Welcome to the Maris Review. I am so delighted to be sitting here with Ara Kwan, or Reese, and she is a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellow. The Incendiaries is her first novel, and it was named a Best Book of the Year by over 40 publications. Now it's in paperback. Welcome, Reese.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Yay! For listeners who may not have read it in hardcover, do you want to give a little intro into The Incendiaries?
Yeah, of course. So it's about a woman who gets involved with a group of fundamentalist Christians. The group turns out to be a cult with ties to North Korea. And they end up bombing abortion clinics, healthcare clinics in the name of faith.
Right. And it's told from the point of view, though, a man.
Yeah, it's told from the point of view of the man who falls in love with the woman who falls into the cult, and he opposes much of what the cult represents.
I've read so many articles about you already where you talk about how he had a fundamentalist Christian upbringing, and he quit that, lost his faith. And that's something that also happened to you.
Yeah. So I had this sort of strange mishmash of a religious upbringing in that my family's Catholic. Everyone's Catholic. I grew up Catholic. But then when I was in junior high, I started going to my friends' churches.
Oh, interesting.
And a lot of my friends were involved in non-denominational, charismatic, talking in tongues churches. There's a lot of singing and dancing and falling to the ground, which, like, I think as someone in junior high school, and I can imagine even now, that sort of direct access to the ecstatic,
yes,
was so fun. It was so seductive. I loved it. And so I spent a lot more time with that variety of Christianity rather than Catholicism. And so, yeah, I was super religious, thought I was going to be a pastor. And then when I was 17, I left the faith. I lost the faith.
And it was very much like how you describe Will's loss of his faith.
In some ways, those are perhaps the most just like directly autobiographical parts of the book. Just like the enormity of the loss, all the ways in which it's ongoing, you know, it's a daily thing.
Mourning.
Yeah, the mourning hasn't stopped. And I think I'm just only recently starting to come to terms with the fact that, or with the likelihood that I'm never going to stop mourning, that it's just going to, that it's just going to be this way, and that this is just going to continue to shape my life.
I read that it's hard not to write about it.
It is. And it's, you know, sometimes, okay, so with my new novel, I was trying so hard to not just like have a single mention of God in there. And then that fucker just like keeps sneaking back in. It's so annoying.
What a fucker. Can you tell us anything more about your new novel?
Yes. It's about two women, two artists. One is a choreographer, one's a photographer. And the photographer becomes professionally and then personally obsessed with the choreographer. And in the book, I'm really interested in grappling with questions of what women are allowed to want and what we're not allowed to want. And increasingly, it seems to me, and I get nervous when I generalize. As a woman in this world,
yes.
I feel as though anytime I want to take care of other people, that's very acceptable. And not only acceptable, that's desired. Like, people want me to have children. People want me to take care of other people.
Right.
But anytime I want something for myself, whether that has to do with art, ambition, jobs, sex, anything physical.
Right.
If I just want a date of myself, that becomes immediately suspicious in a way, and like something that I have to defend in a lot of ways. And I'm just fascinated by that, by the ways in which it's totally okay to want to help other people, but it's less okay to want things for myself. And so in this book, these women are, they're both artists. They're both very driven, and they really, really, really want things. And I want to see what happens, what it looks like.
Excellent. So they're art monsters, you might say.
Yes. God, Jenny gave us all a gift with that phrase.
She sure did. And she blurbed your book, yes?
Oh, she did. She was one of
Jenny Awful.
Yes, I love her. And I love her writing so much.
Yeah, she came up with this concept that few women get to be just a charismatic artist. Above. So tell me what it's like to kind of revisit The Incendiaries a year after publication. What's that like for you?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. In some ways, it isn't yet a revisiting in that there has been, like for the past year, there's been interviews and events and festivals and speaking engagements where I get to go to universities and other places. I really love speaking at universities and speaking with students. It kind of never really, it's more as though it never really stopped, I'd say.
Wow, that's a lovely thing to hear an author say.
Yeah,
Riverhead's doing well by you.
I'm so lucky, and I feel very lucky. And yeah, I really love speaking with undergrads and grad students. So that's something that I've had a number of speaking engagements, and that's something that I love to keep doing.
Are the questions you receive from undergrads about craft or? I mean, I imagine that on book tour, you experienced many people who had also given up their faith.
They do ask a lot about craft. A lot of them have questions about, like, how to be an artist in the world.
Sure.
You know, just like the practical steps of how to find a life in the arts, which, like, I love talking about because as an undergrad, I had no idea. Like, I was like,
of course.
I was like, I knew there were living writers, but mostly, like, I'd been reading dead white writers. And so I was
That's college.
Exactly. And I was like, well, I know Henry James made a life for himself, but, like, that dude's dead as fuck. Like,
yeah.
And so, like, I didn't know how to figure that out. So that people ask a lot about that. People have a lot of questions about a lot of writers who are marginalized in any way.
Right.
Have a lot of questions about that, like how to write and how to think about writing as like a woman, as a queer person, as an Asian person, as a person of color. And that's always something I love talking about too. Something that is really lovely about talking with undergrads in particular is that they're not stressed out yet about like publication, you know, like they're
they're stressed out about other things.
Yeah. they're still like their love is so pure, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's very like energizing.
In hearing other people talk about your book, did you learn anything about it that you hadn't considered before?
Something that really surprised me was, on the one hand, I love hearing from people. I mean, I love hearing from readers in general, and I really love hearing from people who've lost their faith or who have complicated faith, in part because I felt so alone when I lost my faith. And
right.
So being able to not only provide but receive a little bit of fellowship, that means the world to me. And like, it like pretty much always sets me off crying if someone says like, I'm an ex-Mormon and reading your book like helped me feel less alone. Then I'm just like, oh no, okay, I'm gonna start crying now. It's time for tears. But it's also been really interesting to hear from very religious people. It's not necessarily what I expected. I didn't know what to expect, but very religious people have been reading the book too.
Yes.
And not with hostility, you know, like, and what seems to happen predominantly is that when religious people read the book, they say that they appreciate all the ways in which the book does not laugh at faith.
It doesn't at all.
And it doesn't, it's not a punchline, it's not a joke. Faith is taken seriously. And I think maybe that's partly because that's not as present in fiction and in current fiction, especially not in fiction that's not intentionally geared toward religious people.
Right.
And so that's been really lovely too, is having conversations with people who are very religious and just, I don't know, talking through things.
Off the top of your head, who else is doing it really well? Like talking, I mean, Marilyn Robinson.
Oh my God, she's so good.
She makes me want to be a good Christian. I'm Jewish.
Oh my God, she's amazing. This is a little to the side, but I love the ways in which Anne Carson talks about faith.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She's just it's really interesting, and she just the ways that she talks about like what she believes and doesn't believe and like the absence of faith, like it's fascinating, and she's just so good in general. Like I love her brain.
She has a good brain.
She has such a good brain. All of it, really. I feel as though Knox, I don't even know if the appearance of faith explicitly appears, but because it's about a lost brother, like about death, the specter of what that means sort of haunts the whole book. And yeah, that's one that comes to mind.
Tell me about writing an unreliable narrator.
So part of me, there is an extent to which I'm not sure I ever think a narrator is all that reliable,
sure.
No matter who they are. And even in like the most like, you know, omniscient third person, mm-hmm. middle march narrator,
right.
who knows exactly what's going on with everybody narrator, like that's still, that narrating voice is still has a personality.
Right,
like
of
they,
course.
They have opinions. They're choosing what to fit, what to look at. And so there is that. On the other hand, it's also true that Will, the narrator of The Incendiaries, is a little on the spectrum of extremely reliable to extremely unreliable. He's not extremely reliable, let's say. I guess I didn't set out to write a book that way. It was more just following the characters and seeing who they were and what they wanted, what they were doing with one another, why they were even on the page. That narrative voice arose out of that.
I found it just fascinating to see him coming out of religion and what he's not used to and what he's not accustomed to. But also he's not wealthy and he goes to college with a bunch of guys who wear Nantucket Reds and go yachting or something. But like, were there things you or mm-hmm. Will like didn't know mm-hmm. like from the get-go upon getting into the secular world fully?
Oh. I mean, there's a lot Will doesn't know, and so
yeah.
There's the part when he's at like a party and people are dancing, and he's like, I have no experience of dancing.
Yeah.
Like as like someone, Will having grown up very religious, Will hadn't been on a lot of dance floors. There is an extent to which I brought some of my own experiences into that. When I was religious in high school, I tried not to listen to like secular music.
Right.
Like that was the kind of thing that like pastors would say would. Like secular music is like more sinful. And so I listened to a lot of Christian music. I listened to a ton of classical music. I was also mm-hmm. pretty serious about the piano. And classical music was just fine. So then when I got to college, I realized, oh, and this is the other thing. My parents, I'm Korean. My parents didn't want me to watch TV really. And like, because they were just like, it's bad for your brain.
Sure.
And so,
yeah.
And I say Korean because a lot of Korean people, including my parents, are like pretty education focused. Mm-hmm. And so they were just like, it's a distraction. Like you don't need it.
Right.
And so I didn't really watch any TV growing up either. And so by the time I got to college, people would make references to things. And I would just be like, I don't know what the fuck that is. Like what are Weezers? And so that was like that's actually still a thing for me. Like very often someone will bring up something from pop culture and I'll have no idea. So my strategy now is just to, it doesn't even really bother me. It's more just that like, I don't want to like draw attention to,
sure.
I don't want to like derail the conversation to be like, oh, it's Reese not knowing a thing again.
Right, right.
And so I just like stay quiet and like nod along.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fair. What were some of the things that you first really grasped onto when you were watching TV or listening to secular music?
I don't think I've ever talked about this part, but okay. After I got into college, when I'd gotten just a little bit more chill about my studies, I was like, well, I've been this like extremely studious, extremely driven student for a long time. I had never tasted alcohol. I had never like,
right.
I definitely hadn't had sex. Like mm-hmm. I'd like barely kissed a couple of boys, maybe. So then I just started watching, of all things, Dawson's Creek.
Oh, sure.
Not because I just wanted to know what like, not normal's the wrong word, but like what like other high school students were up to. Like I wanted mm-hmm. to know how to like, I feel as I'm going to have to fit in a different way. Like, how do I do that? And so I tried to learn how to be like a teenager. And
So Pacey, when he sleeps with his teacher, that was like.
I know. I was like, this is wild. Like these children have no parental supervision.
None
They're just wandering
all.
Around. They're never studying.
Yeah, they're talking about film and hanging by the creek.
Yeah, exactly. They're like sleeping over. My parents did not let me sleep over at anyone's house until maybe like junior year of high school. And they would only let me sleep over at people's houses when it was for like a group project. So when it was for school and we were staying up late. So I missed out. I still regret this. I missed out on all those pivotal 13-year-old, 14-year-old sleepover parties when you stay all night. I mean, they're very sweet and very close to them. They would pick me up at like 1 a.m. They'd be like, you can't sleep over, but we'll pick you up at 1 a.m. So I could stay for a little bit, but then I would miss the like real shit, you know, like when the like real gossip goes down.
I was the exact same way. And it was my parents would claim that it was because, and I think they're right, I would get sick if I stayed up all night.
Yeah, so I guess as a kid, that's fair.
So I would like, but I would always feel like I was leaving just when shit was starting to get good.
Yes, like it would be right when everyone was talking about like starting to like confess their like crushes. I'd be like, I need to go now. Like, you're destroying my social life.
I have to touch on this because I'm sitting across from you for the first time in real life. And I'm looking at your beautiful face and your eyeliner. Tell me a little bit about that or tell listeners a little bit about that for people who don't know.
Sure. First of all, I'm delighted to be sitting across from you for the first time. I feel so we've like chatted online for like for
years.
A while. Yeah. And like I've been following your work for so long and admiring it. And anyway, I'm so glad to be here. So I started, I don't even know the timeline anymore. Like it was like maybe 3 years ago. I was just like in a really bad place, not in a really bad place, but I was on like year seven, seven and a half, eight of my novel that I've been working on. And I just
That'll
was like,
do it.
I was just like a little down, you know, like, what am I doing with my life? And then I just, you know, like I kept, and I would go out into the world and I would just seem cheerful. I think like I read as being like pretty cheerful.
Sure.
I read as being pretty happy. And I just hated that my exterior was not matching my interior in any visible way. And then that was when I just started playing around more with eyeliner. And then I just sort of like settled on something that made me look a little less like a cheerful person just wandering around our day, you know?
Yeah.
That's when I started wearing and wearing like heavier black eyeliner.
And so now it's your signature look, you could say.
Although now I'm thinking about switching it up. I don't exactly know what I'll do.
You can.
Yeah.
You should.
I know. I don't know what. I'm like not actually very good at makeup, you know? Like I'll like hit on a thing and I'll just like do it for years. Like,
right.
Like I use the exact same like brow powder that I've been using since high school when I went to prom and the woman at the clinic counter like put it on me.
Check these out.
Yeah. And I was just like, okay, yeah, that works. And I've never really switched it up ever since. But so yeah, I'm not like, I don't like have like very many like makeup skills, but we'll see. Maybe I should like look at like those tutorials that people like watching.
They're weirdly addictive.
Do you have any you'd recommend?
Mostly they're things on Instagram.
Oh.
I'll DM you. What else have you been reading in this past year? What else is good right now?
I really love Esme Wang's book,
The
Collective
so
Schizophrenia. I think I saw that she might be on here or...
Well, I'm waiting for her to come into New York City so
awesome.
We can do it.
Awesome. I love that book so much. It's just like so brilliant, so compassionate.
It is.
So generous, but also so rigorous.
Agreed.
There's a forthcoming book from Pam Zhang, How Much of These Hills is Gold, and it's coming out in like April.
Okay.
It's about a Chinese American family in the midst of a fictionalized version of the gold rush. And so, which isn't a story that like I never read like a book length account of Chinese Americans during the gold rush. And like, of course, especially given
there.
The time, yeah, they were there. And it wasn't easy, you know, like it was.
No kidding.
It wasn't easy at all. And so it grapples with race in really profound ways. It grapples
Great.
With grief. There are like bizarrely beautiful, grotesque descriptions, like prolonged descriptions of a corpse that like I'm probably never going to recover from.
Like, wow.
So that's really wonderful. And yeah. Those are a couple off the top of my head.
Thank you. And what else have you been listening to or watching?
I'm watching, I mean, I guess everyone is. I'm still in the middle of watching the second season of Villanelle, which I love so much.
Oh, yeah.
And I've been trying to figure out what it is I love so much about it, because there are ways in like that first season, things get a little cheesy, like things get a little too much. But I think there's just something so exciting. Again, getting back to this question of like what women are allowed to want. Like they're so ferociously devoted to pursuing what they want.
And both of them are so good.
Yes. Like, there's something about competence. Like competence is fascinating, you know?
Yes.
Like seeing depictions of competence, the competence itself is fascinating. Competence is very sexy.
Right?
Yeah. I'm so interested by why that show is so interesting to me. Because normally, like, when there are elements of cheesiness, I start getting turned off. when, like, plausibility starts being stretched in ways that don't seem to follow the rules of the world that they're in.
Right.
I start getting really turned off. But yeah, I've been really loving that show.
I have to catch up. I'm also mid-season.
Yeah. It's so interesting.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. It was a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. This is delightful.
Yay. Thank you for listening to the Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.